The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
We are pleased this morning to have probably one of the most famous people on Wall Street, really. As far as individual investors go, this man probably is known as much as anyone out there. We've got Gary Schilling with us this morning. He's a financial analyst and commentator, appears regularly on everything from Forbes to the New York Times to the Wall Street Journal. He's the president of A. Gary Schilling & Company and editor of A. Gary Schilling's Insight, which I highly recommend that you get. We'll be talking a little bit more about that later on the show. But it's a great, great read, and it really will bring you up to date on what's going on, kind of give you an idea of the real story of what's going on in the markets. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning to you.
Good morning. Hey, listen, I'm going to start off with a quote that came out this morning from Seth Klarman to ask you what your thoughts are. He said, and this is what Seth said this morning. He said, any year which the S&P jumped 32%, the NASDAQ 40%, while corporate earnings barely increased should be a cause for concern. Are you concerned out there about what's going on?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, last year, the vast majority of the rise in stocks was a price-earnings play, which is exactly what my very good friend Dennis was talking about. And the earnings growth itself was not because of fundamentally based increase in sales volume or pricing power, the ability to raise prices, slow economy, no inflation. It was increased profit margins, and that's come through cost-cutting. Profit margins are at an all-time high, and you really say, what do they do for an encore? So I think you've got a risk to margins. You've got the, you know, this very slender basis of the rally last year. And again, what do you do? Now, of course, we went into this year with the vast majority, the herd saying, hey, we're going to have a wonderful economy this year. And they wanted that to justify more of the same in stocks. But they've said that every year since the economy started up in this, you know, rather slow recovery in the middle of 2009. And every year that's been frustrated. That includes the Fed. The Fed starts out every year forecasting about 4% growth, ends up where it's been for 4 years, 5 years now, 2%.
Right. Yeah, every year they start out. You're absolutely right. They start out with the same prediction every year, and then they just begin to adjust it so that by the end of the year we end up with half of what we've got.
In a book I wrote in actually back in 2010, the title was The Age of Deleveraging, Investment Strategies for a Decade of Slow Growth and Deflation. And in that, I said we were going to have 2% average real GDP growth as long as this deleveraging lasted. It normally takes about 10 years, a decade. We're 6 years into it, so we're up 4 years to go if history's any guide. And, of course, that's been exactly the case so far. It's been about 2% GDP growth, and I see no reason why that's going to change going forward.
And you're absolutely right. Deleveraging is a form of deflation, but we really haven't been able to use the D word. We really haven't had the significant deflation that a lot of people thought. Why is that?
Well, I think it's because of the massive monetary and fiscal stimuli that we've had. To me, that's the only thing that's really held it off.
So we basically have an economy, and I think a stock market that's being held up by the Fed. I saw a chart the other day that shows the amount of money that the Fed has put in, and running along that line is the S&P 500, and it clearly shows that as the Fed has put more money into the system, it's driven stocks higher.
Now the Fed's cutting back on that largesse. They've cut back from $85 billion a month to $75-$65 billion, and they say they're going to be at zero by the end of the year.
So what happens now then? Well, if that's the case, if this market has been climbing the wall with the Fed on the backs of the Fed, since the Fed is pulling out, what happens now? Do you expect the market to pull back significantly by the end of the year?
Well, we just came out with our March newsletter, Insight, and in that I talk about the fact that we still are in a risk-on status in terms of investors. They're still looking for higher stocks. But this is against the backdrop of a lot of issues. The Fed pulling back, we talked about, the problems with the emerging markets, China We can talk about that specifically. That's a lot of issues there. We've got, of course, the uncertainty of what's going on in Ukraine. Commodity prices are falling. The employment situation is very poor. Consumers have cut back their retail sales both in December and January. In other words, you've got a lot of housing is really looking pretty much like it's topping out. You've got a lot of signs that suggest the economy is certainly not roaring ahead, and you've got problems elsewhere in the world. But yet, despite that, we still have risk on. So what we're doing in portfolios we manage is take a very defensive approach to it. We're emphasizing things like utilities that have dividend cushions, meaningful dividends, health care with Obamacare and aging post-war babies, consumer staples, things people buy every day regardless. And so we're looking for niches, in effect. We're saying, yeah, it's still risk on, but we want to approach this cautiously.
Yeah, you mentioned the housing recovery. All morning today they've had on CNBC, they've had the guys from Home Depot. They had the chairman of Home Depot. They had the CEOs of various companies that like Masco that supply Home Depot. You mentioned in your insight that the housing recovery has been driven primarily, I guess, by the rental market, not the solid foundation of new homeowners. And it seems like it's getting harder and harder for people to qualify for a new home. And it looks like, according to your work and other work I've seen, it looks like that the strength in the housing market is beginning to slip. Is that what you see out there?
Yeah, I think so, because at some point you satisfy the rental demand. Multifamily housing starts, apartments, most of them for rent, rental apartments, have pretty well recovered to the average they had to the last decade, around 300,000 annual rate. But single family, you know, it was up at 1.2 million. It's now running about 500,000. It's really still very, very depressed. But between the multifamily, the apartments that have been built, and the single family houses, foreclosed houses that have been bought by both individual and institutional investors and converted to rentals, I think we're pretty well satisfying that rental demand. And of course, a lot of people don't rent, they don't own, they stay home. You know, if you look at the number of people aged 25 to 30 to 34 who are living at home with their parents, that's going straight up, and the home ownership of people under 35 is going straight down. People are saying, hey, I can stay home. It's cheap. Mom's cooking is great. She does the laundry.
Yeah, and, you know, housing is such a big part of our economy, and certainly the recovery in housing has helped brought a lot of, at least a lot of positive attitudes about the recovery of the economy and the market. If housing begins to slip back into the doldrums that it was in, that has a significant impact on the market as a whole, don't you think?
Well, it does. You know, housing, it's very important in terms of its volatility. It's actually a small segment. At its peak in 2005, it only accounted for 6.2% of GDP, but it went from there down to 2.5%, and that 3.7 percentage points drop in itself was a major recession. So it's the volatility of housing, and of course, on top of that, you've got not only the residential construction spending to build a place, but also the appliances and furniture and cars that go with new housing. So it's very important in terms of its volatility. And yeah, it hasn't accounted for a lot. It's accounted for of the growth in real GDP and recovery so far only about 20%. But obviously, if that were removed, it would be an even weaker situation. And it does look recently like how you look at sales of existing housing, pending sales. These are contracts for houses that'll be closed on in a couple of months. You look at the attitude of builders. All these things have slipped.
Well, folks, you're probably getting an idea why you need to get a copy of Gary Schilling's Insight. So when we come back, we're going to find out from Gary how to do that. We're also going to talk to him about China and what's really going on over there. Stay with us. You're listening to the Mike Robertson Show, where we bring you the wisdom of Wall Street each and every day. Back in a moment.
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
We're talking today with Gary Schilling. Gary Schilling has a great, great publication called Insight. And Gary, I'd like to start off first by asking you, how can folks sign up and subscribe to Insight?
Well, they can go to our website, www.agaryschilling.com, GARYSHILLING, all one word, and it's SH, no C. Or they can call our toll-free number, 888-346-7444.
So now, you've been around a long time. Well, in fact, one of your first prognostications that you're well known for is one that you made in 1969 when you correctly envisioned the recession at year's end. So you've obviously been around a while. Don't you think this is the market's just gotten a little ridiculous when they're putting up, you know, that this is like we're opening up down for for 3 days, and so this is the worst 3 day period since the end of January. It's kind of like they're micromanaging the market. Isn't this getting to where it's just plain silly?
Well, I've seen a lot of markets since back then, 1969, when I was Merrill Lynch's first chief economist, and you know they come and go. But I think that, you know, the market is very precarious, and I think it's probably going to take a major shock to really push investors into reality. And you know that could be what's going on in Ukraine now, the emerging markets, their problems, China, and we want to talk about China. It could be a blow up in the Middle East with a spike in oil prices, or the same in Venezuela, and higher oil prices are a tax on consumers. It could be a number of things. You take your pick, but I'm not sure people are going to give up easily, because you know this has been a winning game since March of 2009 on balance, and very few people quit when they're winners. They play till they lose.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about that during the break, that casinos really bet on the fact that even that if you start getting a winning hand, that you'll stay, and you'll stay long enough until you turn it into a losing hand. So I guess that's what we've got going on now. So I keep looking for that outside shock, as you call it, that event risk is what I call it.
Let's look at China in that regard, because I'll give you six problem areas in China. One is they're slowing growth, and fast growth covers a multitude of sins. Slowing growth, as we've seen in this country with the Great Recession and so on, is a problem. Secondly, they're trying to convert that economy from one led by exports and the infrastructure to support those exports to consumers, consumer-led. They know that export game no longer works. The exports, where did they go? To the U.S. consumer, to Europe, and with slow growth both there, they don't have that market. And shifting the economy, a massive economy like that, is a problem. Third, they're flexing their muscles militarily. Their defense spending is going to go 12% this year. The economy probably 7.5%. They're arguing over a few rocks with Japan and everybody else in the area. You don't know what's going to come out of that. Fourth, they're trying to stop the speculation in their currency, the yuan. They've knocked it down recently. It was rallying. Everybody counted on that and was speculating. Fifth, they've had this shadow banking. This is because they pay very little for deposits, less than 1%. The shadow banks pay 6%. It's pulling money away. And just like the yuan, these guys there are control freaks. They don't want to see things get outside their control, and they're trying to bring that under control. And the sixth thing is that they're trying to bring in austerity. They're saying no more fancy banquets and big Tiffany $50,000 diamond bracelet gifts, austerity. And, you know, it's a bureaucracy that's really used to all that lab spending going to come to heel. Now, here's the question. Suppose they get a real problem there with their trying to curb the yuan speculation or the shadow banks or any of these problems looked in. They've got all the money they need to bail out anybody. But so did the Fed. And if you look back, the Fed just released the transcripts. They do this with a 5-year lag of what they actually said in their policy meetings, word by word, in 2008. And lo and behold, guess what? The Fed, by their own admission, was behind the curve. Now, the subprime market actually started to break in February of 2007. Yet, over a year later, the Fed didn't understand what was going on. The Fed has all the money in the world. They created out of thin air. They can bail out anybody, but they didn't prevent runs on the banks, runs on Bear Stearns, runs on Lehman Brothers, the near collapse in Wall Street. That's the analogy. Is China, if they get this kind of problem, I'm not saying it's going to happen, but if they do, are they going to be any better than the Fed? at executing. It isn't the will, it isn't the ability, it isn't the money. It's the execution that matters here. And so I think China has a potential for a really serious problem here, particularly in the financial area. And China's the biggest economy in the world, and that easily spreads to all the other emerging markets in Asia. They're all dependent on exports. A lot of those exports go to China, slowing economy there. They don't need iron ore and copper and soybeans and all these other things that Brazil and Indonesia and all these countries export to China.
Yeah, in fact, copper's getting crushed this morning, which is usually
an indicator. We're short copper in our portfolios, and I love copper. The two routes that we have in our portfolios is the route to China, are short copper and short the Australian dollar. Because Australia is you know, they're digging up the island continent and sending the iron ore and coal and everything else to China.
Right.
And the other thing is copper. And copper goes into almost anything manufactured. It's a great indication of global economic activity. China's been stockpiling massive amounts. They consume about 42% of the annual global production in copper. And we look on copper. As a matter of fact, we just stepped up our positions in copper a couple of days ago, and I'm glad we did because it's been a wonderful, wonderful short.
Yeah, it really has. Are you getting ready for a significant market pullback?
Well, as I say, we're taking a very defensive approach to this. Now we are not only long defensively, as I mentioned in the first segment, with utilities, consumer staples, healthcare, but we also have a sizable position in long treasury bonds. And of course, when you see a day like today, when stocks are in trouble, you can bet almost automatically the treasuries are going to be up, and they're really up very strongly today. This is a safe haven. What are the safe havens? The safe havens are the dollar and treasuries. Those are the safe havens. And when you get into a period, what do you want to avoid? Commodities, which get killed with global decline. We talked about copper and also stocks in general. And it's not only developed country stocks, but it is stocks in emerging markets. Now, is this the big, you know, is it the big downer? Is this the thing that's going to take the stock market down, you know, 20, 30, 40%? I don't know. I think it's too early to say. It could develop into that. But again, we're taking a very cautious approach in the meanwhile. And, you know, we're stepping up things like our bets against China.
Hey, Gary, can you stay on for just a few more minutes?
Sure.
Okay, great. Yeah, because I've just got a couple other questions to ask you. We're coming up to a break. So, folks, we're having a great show today. I hope you're enjoying it. If you want to give Gary a call, it's 877-711-5611. But if you have one question, I'll have opportunity for one on the other side of the break. So stay with us. You're listening to the Mike Robertson Show, where we bring you the wisdom of Wall Street each and every day. Back in a moment.
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
Well, we've had a great show today. We've had with us Gary Schilling, American financial analyst and commentator. Go to agaryschilling.com and sign up for his newsletter, The Insight. It is a tremendous piece and something that if you're a serious investor, you need to be getting this publication. So go sign up for it. I think you'll really, really be glad you did. Gary, before the break, we were talking about China, and you and I spoke a little bit during the break. One of the things that really confuses me is that so many people say you can't trust the numbers out of China. So I always keep wondering, you know, am I ever going to really know what's going on behind the screen in China? And because a lot of people say, you know, that's going to be the other shoe to fall. That's going to be the event that's really going to cause us to get a big dose of reality in over here and in our markets. But if you're not getting the real numbers, that may never take place.
Well, you can't trust the numbers. China, for example, their gross domestic product numbers, they announce them 18 days after the close of the quarter, and they never revise them. They get them right the first time. It takes the U.S. Commerce Department 29 days, and I think we've got a lot better statistical methods and measurements. And in China, hey, there are places you probably can't get into except in dry water by ox cart to measure things. I think it's a case of the guys on the top say, we're going to have 7.5% growth this quarter. And the statisticians say, don't worry, boss, coming right up. Yeah, but there are ways you can measure it. There are some independent surveys. HSBC, the big British bank, has a purchasing manager's index. It's consistently lower than the official figures. It comes out about a week earlier. It's one of the few. But markets tell it. If you've got free markets, and if you see, like, for example, you see the Australian dollar going down. Australia's basically become a Chinese colony. If you see copper coming down, very important to China's manufacturing. If you see the Shanghai market going down, as it is, if you see Hong Kong, these are real live, freely traded markets, and they tell the truth. So I think that's where you really want to concentrate. Forget the official numbers. Nobody trusts them, and there's no reason you should anyway.
All right. Well, let's shift a little bit. That I think that's a good explanation. Thank you for telling us that. Let's shift to Europe, because especially late last year and early this year, everybody was saying kind of go east, young man. They're saying, okay, go to Europe now. Things have settled down there. Everybody's turning around. Even Greece looks better. The worst is over with there. What are your thoughts on Europe?
Well, there is this argument that Europe has been in the doldrums. They had a very long but shallow recession, lasted about 3 years. They started to come out of it about the middle of last year, but slow growth. And there is something to be said that stocks are relatively cheap, but that's the same argument people made for the emerging markets 3 or 4 years ago when they jumped in, and, of course, a lot of them have regretted it subsequently. The thing about Europe is, particularly the Eurozone, they combine the Teutonic North with Club Med South under one currency, but with no common fiscal policy and none really possible given the vast difference in cultures. And it really is a very tough combination to really have work. They have to have everybody agree when they have major changes. It's like the Articles of Confederation in this country, and they finally did away with that and put in a constitution where at least somebody, Congress can make decisions for everybody. It's just not a very viable thing. It resulted because the French and the Germans after World War II decided they needed to get together economically to get away from the way they communicated for hundreds of years, and that was all-out war. And it was a noble experiment, but it's a very tough one, and I just don't think Europe is an area that I would want to bet on long term, at least right now, because particularly in a time when U.S. economic growth is slowing, as we talked earlier in the program, as China looks like it could be in serious trouble, those are the number one and number two largest economies of the world, and if you get problems there, you're not going to find many places to hide. This idea that there are these safe havens that are going to do well. You've got the big boys in trouble. That just is. There's no historic support for that argument.
And then, what do you think of interest rates? I'm kind of hitting a bunch of things right here at the end.
Well, I've been a fan of 30-year Treasury bonds since 1981. The yield then was 15.21%. At that point, I said we're entering the bond rally of a lifetime, and the yield is now below 4%. And of course, that has meant that those bonds, if you bought those bonds back then, they have outperformed the S&P since its low in 1982 over six times. And of course, long treasuries are only suitable for little old ladies or orphans. The only reason I've ever bought long treasuries and still do is because I think interest rates are going down. I couldn't care less what they are as long as they're going down, because when they go down, the prices go up. I think the yields could go lower. I rather suspect they'll break 3% on long treasuries and 2% on the 10-year. Why do I say that? First of all, I think we are in slow growth at best and possibly recession looming here at some point. Secondly, we're very close to deflation, and that also is very favorable to treasuries. Third, they're definitely a safe haven in a world, in a global sea of trouble. So I think you got a trifecta there in favor of treasuries. I'm still a fan of those, and we use those in our portfolios because if nothing else, they're a very good hedge against any stock positions. When stocks are going down like today, treasuries are soaring in price.
Wow, you're the first person I've had to come on that doesn't think rates are going up. Most of them say rates are going up maybe next year.
I'll tell you, Mike, for 32 years, the herd has said rates have got to go up. They've got to go up. And, there are a lot of reasons. I talk about that in our Insight publications. I talk about it in this book, The Age of Deleveraging. everybody has a bias against Treasury. Stockholders don't like Treasuries because they know that when Treasury prices are going up, yields are going down, stocks are going down. So they hate them that way. The guys who manage them don't like them because they say, hey, if rates go down, then I got to replace my holdings at lower rates. But even though they're making capital appreciation, rates go up, they say, I'm losing money on capital. They hate them. You look at brokers. They don't like them because there's no commissions on treasuries. They want the higher commissions on stocks. I mean, there's virtually no. There's only a few of us who have consistently loved treasuries, and to say I have for 32 years, and it's been by far the best investment I've ever had, and I think we're still in this bond rally of a lifetime.
Well, I'm glad to hear that because I'm glad rates are not going up. I'd like to see them, and if nothing else, I'd like to see them stay flat for a while. Listen,
well,
Gary, thank
right,
you.
And we've got another 4 years or so before this deleveraging is over. And, you know, when you get deleveraging, what it is, you know, working down the excess debt in the financial sector and condensing and consumers working down their debt, this is so immense that it has overcome the massive monetary and fiscal stimuli we've had in the last 5 years. And the result? Slow economic growth. If you didn't have that deleveraging with all this monetary and fiscal, that, you know, the Fed easing, pumping money out, the tax cuts, spending by federal government, we'd have the economy through the roof into serious inflation. But we're not. We're slow growth. So the deleveraging, as long as that deleveraging continues, and if history's any guide, it's another 4 years to run, I think we'll be looking at low rates engineered by the Fed and probably even lower rates on the long end of the Treasury curve.
Well, that sounds like good news. Well, listen, Gary, thank you so much for being with us today. We really appreciate the time you've taken to be with us. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure. Hope we can do it again soon.
Yes, have a great day. Thank you.
You have been listening to a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.